Welcome to Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here is the podcast host, James Dellingpole.
Welcome to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Anne-Marie Waters, the leader of the new party, new political party for Britain. Anne-Marie, I'm really glad that I finally tracked you down, because I know it's quite tough being the leader of any political party, isn't it?
As I'm finding out, it's tough to run for leader of a political party. It's tough to form a political party. I've never done anything like that before, either role. So you learn as you go. I'm learning a lot at the moment. It's an interesting life I'm living, to be honest.
I met you, I think, about 5 years ago at one of the UKIP conferences, and you were speaking. You were pretty much a civilian in those days. You were talking at some fringe event about Islam in Britain, and I did not come away from that meeting thinking this woman is dangerous. She is a far right activist or a fascist or anything like that. I just thought, here is an ordinary girl talking common sense stuff that not enough people are saying. And I just, before you came, I read your Wikipedia entry, which has clearly been written by people on the left, people from HuffPost. It quotes the Huffington Post, it quotes the Guardian, and all the way through, it's full of suggestions that you are basically a fascist. Mm-hmm. Tell me, you're not, are you?
Look, I'm not an. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. I'm a Democrat, and if anyone who ever listens to me will know that that is my consistent message and has been my consistent message for as long as I've been speaking publicly. I believe in democracy. This is not fascism, and I believe that if we had democracy, we wouldn't be having these problems, because the people are being lied to. Just deceived at every opportunity by the media, by the politicians, by the political class. And if we remove that, if the people's voice was actually heard and they were allowed to say what they really think, i.e. we had a democracy, we wouldn't be having many of the problems we have today. The people, we should trust the people to rule. The majority are decent and principle-minded, and they would do this right if we let them. But instead we have a clique, a political elite, which sees the electorate as a problem to be overcome every 5 years rather than a master to answer to. I suggest we turn that in the other direction and start answering to the people. If that's fascism, then, you know, I mean, this is an egg. If that's fascism, anything is whatever we want it to be. Yeah. Fascism has a definition. I don't meet it. Therefore, I'm not a fascist.
Yeah. I mean, you come from the political left anyway. You stood as a Labour candidate twice. So presumably you were, when you left university, you felt like you were a socialist?
Oh, no, not. I don't like political labels, and I don't want to put them on me. I do all my own thinking for myself, so I don't kind of go to a different philosophy and see whether I agree with that or not. I've done all my own thinking, and I have different ideas about various things, and that's the political career I want to pursue, is my own thinking rather than any already decided or defined political philosophy. Labour was closest to, I mean, plus I'm working class and Labour seemed like the natural place for me, but it was closest to things. I was very strongly supporter of the NHS. I still am, and I was working in it. I worked in it for some years.
What were you at?
I was a secretary.
Right.
I was a secretary for about 8 years while I was going to law school at weekends. And then I left to work in various law firms. And I've always sort of, when I needed money, gone back to the NHS and worked, done temping and stuff. The NHS has been a big part of my life. I mean, Labour was the closest thing to it. The only options, I thought, were Labour and the Tories.
Do you not think that really you would have been in some ways a perfect Thatcherite in that you come from a working class background, you've worked your arse off, that's an inspirational story in itself, the fact that you studied for law while working as a secretary, and I mean, in one version of this fairy tale story, you could be now coining it in as a very highly paid lawyer, rather than taking all this flack doing what you're doing now.
Quite, and believe me, I'm not coining in it at all.
I'm sure you're not.
And, you know, I could have been a lawyer, I could have been an MP, I think, if I'd stayed with Labour and towed the line. But you can't. You know, what is the point in putting yourself through all of this if you're going to betray yourself, if you're going to betray your beliefs? So the price I've paid has been quite high, and it will remain high. I'm not finished paying the price yet. I think I'll be paying it probably for the rest of my life. I certainly don't think I'm ever going to be rich. But speaking of Margaret Thatcher, you know, I've started reading her in the last few years, and it tells you the extent of the brainwashing. I mean, you never hear anything positive about Margaret Thatcher on the left, ever. And I learned, as I said, set out and did my own thinking and learned that, yes, you're probably right, I probably would have been. Not completely, because I don't completely fit any ism or ite, but yeah, I probably would. I probably would be something of a Thatcherite.
Because Margaret Thatcher famously said she was not a feminist, and you describe yourself as a feminist.
Yeah, it's not something that really matters to me a great deal. But I defend the word because I know that a lot of the time people attacking it are actually attacking women's rights, i.e. attacking my rights. You know, some people can pretend they're talking about third wave feminism, which is lunacy, and I've said so many times. But also many are actually saying that you shouldn't be here, I shouldn't be here, I'm a woman, I shouldn't be a political leader, for example. And if someone is telling me, you know, you shouldn't be here, I'm going to fight back. That's degrading and humiliating of my gender, and I'll fight back. So I defend the word feminism from the current lunacy that it has turned into. But like I say, I really only defend it because I know that many people are talking about my rights when they condemn feminism, and I'll fight back.
I was thinking actually then the other path you could have taken, you know, we've described the Thatcherite path. The other path you could have taken, as you said, you could have been a successful Labour MP because you have many qualifications. You've got the working class card. You could have overplayed you could have played well the feminist card. You could have played the lesbian card. Identity politics is all about. That's what Labour is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if I had towed the line on this particular issue, on the issue of Islam, I could have succeeded in Labour. I've got no doubt about that. But I was talking about this the whole time I was in Labour as well. I've certainly hardened on it over the years. I didn't speak quite the way I do now. But I've given talks to Labour Party branches on Sharia law and persuaded them to vote to support, for example, Baroness Cox's bill, which has been going through going through Parliament for years now, again and again. So they were receptive to issues about Sharia law. But I think when I stood in the selection to stand against Caroline Lucas in Brighton, I was in the lead in that selection process, and certainly at many pre-hustings, we either came in, myself and the other leading candidate, as much of a muchness. And overnight, when I did Oxford, when I did Islam is Not a Religion of Peace, overnight, I mean, people who I had door knocked with for a year literally turned their backs against me and wouldn't speak to me because I dared to say that Islam wasn't a religion of peace. And I knew then that Labour was absolutely hopeless. I mean, this is Brighton, you know, the gay capital of the country, and I'm criticising an ideology and a political and legal system that executes gays. And this is the Labour Party condemning me, fiercely condemning me, because I dared to say it. It was incredible, and I knew then that was it for me with Labour. I was done.
Can we actually just dwell on that for a moment? Dwell on the absurdity that you sometimes see at marches, gays for Sharia or gays for Palestine or whatever. What would their survival time be in those communities?
Well, very short if they're walking through the streets, letting it be known that they're gay. Look, you see gays in Palestine having to flee to Israel. And this is the insanity of it. They'll condemn Israel in no uncertain terms, but loving the Palestinians, the people who would kill them. And you see with women as well.
Do you have any theories on this cognitive dissonance?
I really think a lot of it is groupthink. They essentially hear someone get applause for something and think that must be right. People I like, people I approve of are applauding that person for saying that. And this repeatedly builds up a sort of a play in your own mind that hasn't been thought through. It's a series of sound bites, a script, if you like, that they never take the time to think through. Partly because they would lose their social circle if they did. I know what it's like to speak your mind to people who don't agree with you, but on the left. They will reject you. You will be in trouble. You will be out of the in-group very quickly, and they'll make life very difficult for you. So it's easier not to question these things and just go along with the crowd. I think that's much bigger aspect of this than we think, than we are prepared to look at. I think the groupthink, the social issues, the being removed from your social group is a huge, huge issue and a big reason why people won't think this stuff through, because they might come to a conclusion that gets them kicked out of their in-group.
It's interesting you say that from your perspective, because it's certainly something that I've experienced in my own circles, that there is a sort of an acceptable way of thinking which ingratiates you to a particular class. And I know, for example, that I would have a much, much easier time if I were pro-Remain, if I toned down my views on Islam or on stuff like economics. It is unacceptable, for example, to speak out against quantitative easing, to speak out against...
Really?
Absolutely. It automatically marks you out as a kind of out there, kind of, you're a bit Austrian, you're a bit of a loon, you know. James is all very well, but if only he weren't so extreme. And you've had this even more extremely than I have, and I totally salute you. This is one of the reasons
first person.
Amory, I've been so desperate to get you on this podcast because I know what utter shit you are going through every day of your life, and I think that people need to know about what you're doing and about. I wanted to find out about your journey. What was the thing? God, I sound like a bloody BBC program now, aren't I? I want to find out what it was that turned you from an ordinary sort of working class girl who might have had a kind of quite a nice life into somebody who swallowed the red pill and chose this life of bravery but also risk and misery.
You know, I observe the world around me. I'm quite sensitive, so I take things in quite deeply. I think quite deeply, and I'm quite affected by things. I've always been quite sensitive. And I observe the world around me. I've got interest in the world around me. And I can see from an objective standpoint that the Western world, the world I was born into, my part of the world, our bit of the world, is the only part that I really want to live in. And as a woman, that's particularly pertinent. And as a gay woman, it's pertinent. We have to protect it. We have to protect it. We have to protect it from internal and external threats. I believe very strongly in liberty, and when I was growing up, I always wanted to get out there into the world and experience things and do things. And I was able to because I'm free. And I don't want the generations that follow us to not be free. So I think we have a duty to them. Other people fought so that I could be free. We should do the same for people who are coming. That's just something I feel really, really strongly about. So much so that I wish I didn't. It's almost it's bigger than I am, if you like. I sort of wish I didn't feel this way, this strongly about it, but I do. And we're only on this earth once. Let's do what we can do.
Were you brought up a Catholic?
Yes.
And I imagine Dublin, what, in the 1970s with a spin?
Yes, yes.
So it would have been very, well, old-fashioned by modern standards.
I think we were never particularly strict Catholics. And we lived in sort of sprawling suburban inner Dublin.
Did you have a horse on your lawn or anything like that?
No, we didn't. You're going to ask me if I had a horse.
I have seen that though.
Oh yeah, oh, you'll definitely see that. Where was I?
You're talking about your Dublin.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we were never particularly strict Catholics. I went to Mass every Sunday. I went to a Catholic school, Catholic girls' school in inner city Dublin. But when I told my mother, I think I was about 13 or 14, that I wasn't going to go to Mass anymore, she said, fine, you know, it's up to you.
Right.
So we were never particularly strict. So yeah, I a normal everyday upbringing, really. I don't think, I mean, Dublin wasn't as, Dublin is very different to the rest of Ireland,
right.
Culturally, and also in
quite
the
cosmopolitan.
80s. Yeah, I mean, it's the only sort of big city in Ireland, and I always sort of think there are three islands. There's Dublin, there's Northern Ireland, and then there's the rest of the Republic of Ireland. Yeah. It's very, very different to the rest. So the attitudes were still very conservative in most of Ireland, in rural Ireland, but in Dublin things were changing. And I think my generation in secondary school, for example, we were already starting to question the church, and it wasn't, I think I came of age around the time of Father Ted, and you know, when,
yes.
when the country was starting to rebel against the Catholic Church, which I saw as a positive thing. I mean, I saw the child abuse scandals with the Catholic priests. I wasn't personally affected by it, but I do know people who were. So I was sort of anti-Catholic Church in my teens because I could see the abuses they were getting away with. And this, I guess, made me interested in religion, particularly from a young woman's perspective. And that brought me eventually to Islam. That attitude was, when I saw Islam, I thought, blimey.
So what was the, was there a kind of, was there a moment when you saw something that made you think, hang on a second, this isn't right, this is not like other religions?
It was gradual, really. It's various different things that I'd seen myself over the years. In Amsterdam, for example, I had a couple of experiences with Moroccan Muslim landlords.
And so got what were you doing
I lived in Amsterdam for 2 years.
Right.
In my late teens.
Right.
I went just to have, you know, just a party for a couple of years. I got a job, a full-time job in a call center over there. I made fantastic friends and I had a great time for 2 years. But it was very difficult to find accommodation in Amsterdam. So we had to move several times. But two occasions was because the landlords wanted more from me than the rent. And the attitude was very, very stark, very noticeable, the attitude towards me as a woman by these men. And you know, one of them stalked me for a while. I couldn't go out without my flatmate, who was a rather large male Dane, and a very good friend. So I had these experiences. And when I came here, when I was a law student, I met a girl. We became friends, and she was a hijab-wearing Muslim. And she told me very matter-of-factly things about her life, about how she was treated by her brothers, and that her sister was on the run somewhere in Scotland because she'd left a marriage and they would kill her. And she tells me all this, you know, very casually, as if it's not a big deal. And I'm stunned. And I started learning about Sharia because family law was the area I wanted to go into, and family law is the practice area of Sharia in this country. And the more I learned about it, the more shocked and disgusted I became. I then started learning about Islam itself, looking at migration from the Muslim world into the West. And see, what I saw terrified me, and I thought, we've got to stand up to this. We've got to stand up to this. We want any kind of future for Western generations to come.
You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Anne-Marie Waters, the leader of the For Britain Party.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about Breitbart News Second Amendment newsletter, Downrange with AWR Hawkins. Features the top gun stories of the week, every week, and guest columnists like Gun Owners of America's Larry Pratt or Armed American Radio's Mark Walters. Also features a review of a firearm or firearm accessory each week. The newsletter downloads on Thursday, comes right to your email inbox. You can subscribe at Breitbart.com/AWR.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Anne-Marie Waters, leader of the For Britain Party. So, would this have been in the 90s that you were in Amsterdam?
The late 90s, yeah.
The late 90s. Yeah. So then it wasn't much, I can't remember, but there was the Rushdie affair was the first, I think, inkling that we had in the West that something was amiss, that mm-hmm. this issue that previously we had thought was contained in far-off countries like the Middle East was suddenly a thing that was going to affect all our lives at home as well. So even in the 90s, I think that was quite a kind of early, that was canary in the coal mine, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and we reacted. That was the moment to react, and we reacted completely wrongly. We reacted with appeasement, with the Salman Rushdie affair. They should have been told in no uncertain terms that while this is a free country, we will not have this burning of books, intimidation, threatening, and violent behaviour because you're offended. This is a free country. You're going to have to live with being offended, and we should have done that. But instead, across the board, the response was, they're offended. It was absurd, and it was historical, and it was a historic mistake.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because in my early days as a journalist, I used to work on the diary of the Telegraph, the Peterborough column. And one of my assignments one day was to go and attend this meeting of Muslims in Kensington Library, I think it was held in. And it was, I think they were demanding Sharia for Britain. And I went along as a sort of, as you might go to see a freak show, really. It was a sort of curiosity thing. And I looked at these guys, and they were all in absolute earnest. They were all, they had all the beards and stuff, and quite a lot of them were white converts, white guys with the beards and stuff. Some of them quite aristocratic ones. I mean, they're sort of known in the community. And I came away thinking, well, if these guys are serious, and they sound like they're serious, then we've got a real problem here. But I can't quite believe that they can be serious, but they sound so, their sincerity was almost alien to our culture, which is all about irony and about, well, go on, they don't really mean it. These guys, it's a bit like Hitler saying talking about Slavic Untermenschen and so on in Mein Kampf, and saying that we've got to subjugate the Jews and the Slavs and stuff, and everyone going, yeah, well, he's only writing a best-selling book. He doesn't really mean
it. Actually, going to do that.
And you're right. We've sleptwalked into this problem, and I don't just think it's an Islam thing. I think it's to do with the philosophy. Would you agree with this? The philosophy of multiculturalism that was very fashionable in the 1970s. That people like Roy Jenkins, the Labour Home Secretary, championed. This idea that we shouldn't judge other cultures by our own standards, we should just accept that everyone had different values, and that we shouldn't privilege one culture over another. Is that when it went wrong?
Absolutely. What we did was denigrate our own culture. And multiculturalism denigrates our culture. It's telling us that all cultures are the same, when they're observably not. Now, the culture that produces the most, none of us are perfect, but the most civilized behavior, the most peace, is one that is superior to one which is frequently violent and oppressive, and with brutal punishments for private lives, for example. I want to live in a country where I can have a private life and it not be policed by bloodthirsty clerics. That I'm allowed to is superior to a place that will where you live your life in fear of death at the hands of bloodthirsty clerics. Now, we have to, we should have done it years ago. Doing it now, we let it become controversial by not doing it. So now it's controversial to say that Western culture is superior to other cultures. And that's this is a big part of the mistake that we've made. We lost faith in ourselves. In a way, there was an arrogance about it. It's a narcissism mixed with self-loathing, really. And that we're so important that we can hate ourselves and it'll have no impact on us. It is having an impact. We're throwing away our own culture. And we will, if we continue on this trajectory, we will find ourselves submitting in more and more ways to a dominant, violent, alien culture. And I don't make any apology for calling it that, because that is what it is.
Yes. Even now, one gets... I wonder if I need another flat white or whether I'm going to get the shakes. Even now, one gets from... May I have one more flat white? Thank you. I like the way these bits of real life intrude on the podcast. Even now, from the politically correct, the BBC classes, let us say, one gets an enormous amount of stick for not differentiating between what they like to term Islamism and Islam. And I think a lot of us would love to be able to say that there is this thing called Islamism, which is bad, and that there is this thing called Islam, which is good. Mm. Because you and I have Muslim friends. We've travelled. I've certainly travelled widely in the Muslim world. When I was younger, I used to love going to the Middle East and North Africa. I've been to Jordan. I've been to Morocco. Particularly if you're a man, I have to say, Arab culture is bloody great. You get everything it comes on a stick. You know, you definitely feel like you're top dog, and you think, ooh, and you can see why Prince Charles is so seduced by this. Mm. And there's all the stuff that is a cliche, but it's also true. The Arab tradition of hospitality, the wonderful kind of meze and all the kind of dishes you eat, this general kind of Lawrence of Arabia thing that goes on, and it's very seductive. So I don't want to diss this whole of this religion, which has given us the Lawrence of Arabia, led to all that sort of Lawrence of Arabia stuff, and all the Alhambra and all the things that one likes about the Muslim world. And so I can see why people are seduced by this argument that Islamism is completely separate from Islam. But it's not, is it?
No, it's not. You know, there's no Quranism. There's only the Quran. And it's coming from the Quran. And the Hadith, of course. But, you know, we have to define these things. And this is part of the problem. We have to define what Islam is. People confuse Islam with Muslims. And this is the big mistake. This is where they're going wrong. This is where the fogginess comes in. Islam is the Quran and Muhammad. And if Islam's not the Quran and Muhammad, then once again, that's an egg. Because nothing is anything. Islam is the Quran and Muhammad. Now, Muslims is different. It's a different word. It's a different concept. Muslims are human beings. And the best way I describe it is the difference between a book and people who read a book is the difference between Islam and Muslims. I'm talking about the book. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't good, wonderful things that have come out of Muslim culture, but it's largely despite Islam and not because of it, because they are human beings who will develop their own ways of doing things, who will develop a culture that is separate almost from Islam, though influence is everywhere. And the way I see it is that the greater influence Islam has, the worse off the people become. So Muslims have at many times pushed Islam back and become freer and developed different cultural aspects which are pleasant. But the more influence that Islam has, the more unpleasant it becomes. And if you look at Indonesia now, for example, Sharia is on the rise in Indonesia. And you're already seeing the lashings, including of non-Muslims, starting to take place. And politicians in Indonesia are now starting to push for greater and greater Sharia, telling non-Muslim politicians not to interfere. So the greater the influence of the scriptures, the more unpleasant it becomes. But we need to make a distinction between Islam and Muslims. That's the real distinction. It's not between Islam and Islamism. This is denial to me. It's an inability, an unwillingness to face up to the harsh realities of what's written in the Quran. And I think people think they have to blame every Muslim in order to blame Islam. They don't. They need clarification on this. It's foggy thinking. Islam is not Muslims.
Yes, it is an illusion that a lot of the BBC classes are very guilty of it. And I think that's where the personal stuff against you comes in and against Tommy Robinson. Now, I've met Tommy Robinson. He's not a racist.
No, he's not.
He's a working class guy like you. He's got mates who are black, mates who are Muslim, but he, and again, there is this attempt to take away the validity of what he says by branding him as Islamophobic, as racist.
I mean, the press has its own agenda. The mainstream press has an agenda. And it seeks to influence public opinion. It seeks to influence how we vote, for example, because it's a moral. They believe themselves to be morally superior, and those who oppose them to be morally inferior. So they will. The far right label is to frighten people away from listening to us, because I think they know that if people listen to us, they would support us.
Where does it come from, this stuff? Because I think I imagine that you don't get any sympathy even from the Conservative press, do you?
Not at all. Not at
how
all.
How do they treat
you? I don't think
you?
I've ever had a positive... I don't know, I really can't recall, except perhaps in Breitbart, I don't think I've ever had a supportive article
yes,
or positive article written
about me. As we know, Breitbart is a far-right lunatic.
there you go.
This is the problem. Just yesterday, at the time of recording, Damien Green, a Conservative minister, described Breitbart as fake news. Now, you can argue about Breitbart's tone, its voice, but you can't really say that it's in the business of making stuff up.
No.
And I find this rather frightening, that as somebody who went into journalism because basically I believe in telling the truth, however ugly it might be, this is anathema to me. And I look at what our mainstream media is doing now, and I think, well, hang on a second. Most Daily Mail readers, for example, I think are probably as concerned as you about the issues that you're constantly raising. And yet, the Mail will only go so far and then no further.
Also calls me far right. The demonisation comes from all quarters because there's a million different reasons that this happens. But what part of it is they simply don't want to face up to the harsh truths that I'm pointing out. And they don't want the public hearing it either. But it can't last. It can't last. I think we're seeing a shift, it's a very positive shift. People are starting to realise that the mainstream media, millions of people, growing numbers of people are realising that the mainstream media can't be trusted. And that in itself is a revolutionary thing. And I think it will continue and it will grow. This won't last. This demonisation won't last. The truth will out.
Tell me a bit about the UKIP election for leader. I mean, I thought, well, I had money on you to win,
and
you cost me bloody 50 quid, Anne Marie. But I thought that. Do you think that actually? How can I ask this without getting myself into legal trouble? Yeah, was it rigged?
I haven't really given that any thought. What I will say about it is it is rather, it did work out very, very well for the establishment of UKIP. It worked out remarkably well for them. I have absolutely, nothing would surprise me. In party politics, nothing surprises me. I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't. It did work out very well for them. But look, that's politics. That's politics. It is possible. I can't see where he got all that support from. But then I didn't know anyone who voted for Paul Nuttall either. So it's all very strange, but it's the past now. It's the past now. Part of me, I mean, to be honest with you, when I was sitting in that room as they were going through the names and saying where we came and what have you, my overwhelming thought was, if I win this, I'm going to have to go downstairs in front of this audience, give a speech to a room where people will be walking out.
Yes.
They will get up and walk out while I'm speaking.
In order to virtue
signal. And I'll do this. Yes,
signal.
Right. And because they'll be genuinely against me. And I'll be doing all this in front of the world's cameras. And I thought to myself, and when I was named a second place, the sense of relief that I didn't have to do that was incredible. And also, that I didn't have to rule a party or lead a party where vast numbers of them are fervently opposed to me. So in a way, it's worked out better than it could have. Second position was if I was going to lose, I wanted to be second, as is probably common sense. But we can start out now. I mean, I know how difficult it's going to be, especially in Britain with the first-past-the-post system. But I know how difficult it's going to be. But at least I know now that the people who join my party are 100% with me, and I don't have to deal with masses who are against me inside my own party. So it's worked out for the best.
Yes, no, I see that. I had a brief flirtation with UKIP politics, very, very brief. And I went to a few local meetings. And the thing that really struck me was that I was in a room, Nigel Farage calls it herding cats.
Mm.
I was in a room with people with so many different opinions of what the party stood for that I thought, I can't represent these people. The reason I was into UKIP briefly was, number one, Europe. I thought it was our best way out of the European Union. And number two, I thought that it would provide a libertarian alternative to the statist, squishy centrist conservatives. And when they were talking about a flat tax, I was rather excited. But, and yeah, I suppose I also expected it to be outspoken on issues that other parties didn't dare talk about, like Islam. But instead, it's just become this weird, irrelevant basket case, maybe? Is that fair?
I think they've joined the mainstream in many respects. I think they were tired of being outsiders.
They
were tired of being picked on all the time by the media. I'm sure they enjoyed it when I was in the leadership contest. And the media suddenly was portraying them as the moderates and me as the extremist. I mean, I remember when I went on Newsnight with Peter Whittle, and Kirsty Walk was so obviously aligning herself with him against this lunatic here. You know, and I think they enjoyed not being bullied for a change and joined in the bullying instead. And I think that's the party's sort of moving itself into that position where it's tired of being attacked and wants to be more mainstream.
Anne-Marie, we can talk about this more in the next section, but in my experience, people are moral cowards and physical cowards more often than not. I've experienced this so many times on programs like Question Times or Any Questions, where I've been on this panel, BBC chosen panel, and I'm with a Conservative MP, and the Conservative MP goes in his head or her head, they go, thank God for that. I am not going to be the most right-wing person on this panel. I can now play off against James Dellingpole
and make myself
look reasonable. They all do it.
Yeah.
The only one I can think of that doesn't do it is Jacob Rees-Mogg. I think he's the only one with any integrity. I'm just trying to think who else there is. Okay, there were sort of less well-known players. I mean, but they all get bought off by the system. They all get given jobs. I've talked to several kind of Tory MPs of my persuasion, and they get given tiny little jobs in the government, tiny little posts, and they say, "Mate, I can't go on your podcast anymore and tell it like it is because more than my job's worth." That's what politics is like, and I think that's why your new party is the only thing you could have done.
Yeah.
It was your baby, and it's your issue. Yeah. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Anne-Marie Waters, leader of the For Britain Party.
Sunny Johnson brings her cutting-edge conservative commentary to SiriusXM Patriot every week on Sunny's Corner.
I didn't learn conservatism from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Mark Levin. No conservative showed up in my school, my neighborhood, or anywhere in my intellectual orbit. I got all my conservatives from my unknowing but conservative principle practicing family and hip-hop.
Sunny's Corner, every Saturday at noon East on Breitbart News Saturday. SiriusXM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Anne-Marie Waters, the leader of the For Britain Party. We were talking in the previous section about bravery, and I think that what you are doing is very brave. It's got to have made you a target, has it not?
Several. It's upsetting. It's upsetting what I read about myself in the papers, and something that occurs to me is everyone I've ever known, all my old friends, anyone I've, you know, could potentially read this and think she's lost her mind. the way I'm portrayed, a friend phoned me and said, "Who is this person I'm reading about in the papers?" I find this quite upsetting. This is the hardest part of it to me. But as for physical violence, I'm not necessarily afraid of that. I take quite a philosophical approach to it, of what will be, will be. But I'm actually more afraid of what happens if we don't fight back than I am of fighting back. So I'm not, people call me brave all the time, but actually I think, I'm not unafraid. I'm just more afraid of living in a Sharia society than I am of fighting back and even being killed. I would rather be killed than live in a Sharia society, and that is the truth.
Are the police at all helpful to you?
Oh, they're always very nice. Yes, I mean, when we went through the Muhammad, when I was setting up the Muhammad cartoon exhibition, which I cancelled because of my family.
So tell me about that. You tried to set up a Muhammad cartoon exhibition.
Not long after Charlie Hebdo.
Where was that going to be?
Well, we had a venue in central London. I won't tell you where.
No.
But we had in any case, the owner of the venue pulled out, and she was extremely apologetic about it.
But totally understandable.
I would love to do it. Because I had contacted all these venues and told them I wanted to put on an exhibition. Several came back.
Yeah.
I said, okay, the exhibition is of cartoons of Muhammad.
Oh,
and then,
by the way.
Silence.
Yes.
Did not hear from them again.
Yes.
After a few days with this woman, she was wonderful. You know, she came back after a few days. I thought I wasn't going to hear from her again. And she said, basically, Sade, let's do it. In the name of free speech, let's do it. In any case, by the end, she said, look, I'm so sorry. I have to worry about my neighbours. I have to worry about my insurance policy. I have to worry about violence. I'm so sorry. I can't do it. And by that time, it was falling apart anyway. But my family were very upset about it. And we had sort of, you know, terror police at the door checking our house, the security of our house. And we had to put in various different security, make various different security measures. And this was a really dark period of my life, to be honest. But the police are very kind. And I think, you know, as they try to be politically neutral, you can often tell that if they could, they would be on your side. And I think this is a huge issue with the police. People often blame the police for the politically correct nonsense and the non-police,
yeah,
non-law enforcing that we have now. But I think the officers, most officers themselves, wish someone would change it.
Where does
Where
does this come from then?
It comes from the left-wing domination of the public sector. The slow march through the institutions. They've got the CPS, they've got the police, they've got the NHS, they've got the education system, they've got universities, all dancing to a hard left tune. And it is a hard left tune. We don't necessarily recognize it as hard left anymore because it's become so mainstream. They've managed to hijack the mainstream and make it their own. And we're seeing it through the institutions, but it's most important in the justice system, to my mind, because people are being killed and raped, and we need justice. We need to stop these things from happening, and that happens when you have justice. Crimes go down when crimes are punished. And we have a free-for-all, especially regarding sexual abuse. We're in a dire situation, and policing is a huge priority to me. We have to turn this around. We have to get rid of this left-wing. You know, they've turned the police into social workers, into considering emotional feelings, and this got nothing to do with the police, nothing at all. And I don't see why they're at gay prides and rainbowing up their cars either. What's gay pride got to do with police? Stay out of it. They send out tweets about National Coming Out Day. What the hell has Coming Out Day got to do with the police? Stay out of it. These are social issues. And if there's a social reason for a crime, that's for the politicians to deal with. It's of no concern to the police. They
Yes.
should be dispassionately, objectively enforcing the law. Social reasons behind crime are for politicians, not for police. But the role has been completely blurred. They are now social workers.
Do you find on your travels anything that gives you hope? For example, do you get responses from ordinary people that makes all the suffering you're going through worthwhile?
Absolutely. I'm contacted every day. It's the most common thing I'm told is I'm so desperately worried about my children and what kind of Britain they're going to be living in. And they think, you know, people are increasingly realizing that they won't be living in a free one if we don't fight back. And the real, you know, people ask me, are we really going to become a Sharia state? That's ridiculous. I'm not suggesting someone's going to stand up in Parliament and announce that Britain's now a Sharia state. What I am saying is that the politicians will legislate so that it may as well be. And that's already happening. And I do envisage, in my lifetime, criticism of Islam becoming a criminal offence. And in that case, you can't criticise things that are carried out in the name of
Islam. Well, de facto, it almost has already.
Right. But, I think it will be a criminal offence to criticise Islam, literally, rather than in the back door. And not in too many years' time either.
It's interesting, when you were talking about your Muhammad cartoons, I was thinking of a certain strain of thinking in sort of the intellectual middle ground, let's say. So people who wouldn't necessarily even define themselves as being left-wing, whose response to your Muhammad cartoons thing would be, of course I believe in free speech, but this is an act of provocation. And you heard this at the same the time of Charlie Hebdo, that somehow that those cartoonists had invited their own destruction by insulting the prophet, in just pushing it too far, pushing free speech too far. What would your response be to that?
We have got to be able to criticize religious leaders in particular. Now, Europe has a long tradition of mocking and satirizing religion, and we must keep it. It is part of what enlightened us, it's part of what made us free, because the clerics will dominate if you allow them to. It is so very important that we're allowed to mock them and ridicule them. Largely because they claim a certain kind of power. You know, politicians are flawed human beings who we can vote out if we don't like them. But religious leaders claim to be speaking on behalf of the leader of the creator of the universe. They claim an absurd kind of power, making our criticism and ridicule of them even more important. Now, if you're going to say that Muhammad cartoons are a provocation too far, you have just announced your defeat. You have just handed your freedom over to bloodthirsty clerics and their minions. You have decided, yes, I will bow down to you. I am happy to live in a society dominated by violent religion. I refuse to say that I will live in a society dominated by violent religion. The Muhammad cartoons, I probably would have had to go on the run if I'd gone through with it.
Yes.
And my better decision was to spend, hopefully, the next 20, 30, 40 years of my life fighting it differently than to ruin it with this. In any case, we are long gone past the point where it will make a difference.
Yes, that's certainly true. Where do you sense the resistance is going to come from? Am I right in thinking that it's the working classes who get this more viscerally than perhaps the middle classes?
Yeah, to me, it's very often the working class, because they're the ones who are sitting at the bottom of the pile and who has to put up with the consequences of the decisions made in Westminster. You know, there's not masses of migrants from Somalia or across Africa that are coming into Europe now. They're not going to the middle class areas to live. They're going to the working class areas, being placed in working class areas. And I'll always remember a woman I used to work with in the NHS. She grew up in Chelsea. She's a working class woman. She grew up on an estate in Chelsea. And I remember her telling me when this is now completely Somali, this estate that she had. She'd lived there an entire life. And I remember her saying to me, and they really hate us. And it was there was this genuine angst from her that all these people had moved into the place she had known and lived her whole life and were treating her with contempt. Now, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. We see Germany now. Germany is a small town country. I lived in a small town in Germany. And now you have tiny little towns in Germany where migrants outnumber the Germans. You know, essentially overnight, their little towns have been destroyed. And no one in Berlin but Angela Merkel does not care about this. So it's the people at the bottom, the ordinary people, the taxpayer, they are the ones who will lead this revolution against the political elite, who are destroying them, destroying their towns, destroying their villages, destroying their familiarity, their familiarity. Your surroundings are being transformed around them. It's not happening to the wealthy. It's happening to the ones at the bottom. So they're the ones who will fight back. I'm certain of it.
Have you witnessed any of this in Germany yourself?
I haven't actually. I'm very interested in Germany, and I've read this stuff. I haven't seen it, but if it's true, then it's, and I have no reason to doubt that it's true, then it's quite shocking that that Germans, I'm talking about a town of 900, I think, received 2,000 asylum seekers. I mean, this is a good. There might not be. It's around those numbers. I'll try and find it for you. The article. I think it was in Breitbart, actually. But I remember being so stunned by it, and having lived in a small town in Germany, I was so shocked. And then I read of the poor old Germans who, you know, handing out letters asking, "Please do not defecate in our gardens. Please do not. You must pay for things in shops before you open them.
Yeah, don't masturbate in the swimming pool changing rooms.
You know,
it's not our way.
Please stop. Please stop asking our daughters to marry you in the street." You know, this kind of thing. I know that small town Germany, and I know how impeccable they are, and they must be just devastated by this. Absolutely. And there's nothing they can do about it. It's shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking.
And so when you go to public meetings, what's the response?
Usually initially very positive, but then, you know, people who come to see me tend to want to come to see me.
Yeah.
You know, meetings I've been doing recently have all been UKIP, and the sort of the response has been very positive from a lot of people. But when we start our public meetings, the For Britain public meetings, I'm quite looking forward to seeing what the response will be. And I think if people are going to come and hear me speak, they'll come for a reason. They'll know, they'll already have thought about some of this stuff and want to know more about it. And, you know, they'll have, even if they haven't got a great knowledge about these issues, they'll have an interest in it and want to learn more. I expect there will be people who won't take very kindly to me, and that's part of the process, it's part of politics. I have to.
I suppose that's what I was really angling for. How do you deal with the hate? I mean, how have you developed a skin thick enough to deal with this stuff?
I'm not sure I have. It is very upsetting, because I am quite sensitive, and I don't. What I really hate is lies. The lies are the part that really get to me. They portray me as a monster, when actually, I'm quite reasonable, and B, I'm opposing brutal violence and oppression. How on earth am I the monster here? That's what really infuriates me. It's the hardest part of it to take. If we looked at this objectively, I am opposing people who want to stone, who want to bury a woman in the ground and stone her, throw stones at her head. You know, this is what I'm fiercely objecting to, and yet the media portrays me as the evil one and the ones who want to throw the stones as the good, as the oppressed, as the victim. It's that is the hardest part to take. It really is.
I asked you about earlier on about the cognitive dissonance that enables gay activists to support Sharia. How as a feminist do you cope with this? How do you explain this thing that we have in our culture, where on the one hand, feminists will tell you that there's a rape culture, which is led by white men apparently. And at the same time, you've got these gangs in Rotherham and, well, all over the country, haven't you? You've got them in Oxford, you've got them in Telford, you've got them in London, everywhere. Have you ever sort of tried reasoning with a feminist out of her stupidity?
You know what, I have. There's one particular person, and I like her very much, but I end up wanting to pull my hair out whenever I talk to her, because she's an intelligent, kind, decent person, but still cannot fathom why we must keep, why we should be closing the borders of Europe to the men who are coming in, and there are still thousands coming in every day, for the protection of women. I cannot fathom how you can call yourself feminist and choose to allow migrant men the ability to live in Europe, because it's not a right, it's simply an ability, to allow them an ability to live wherever they like, i.e. in Europe, and place that over and above a woman's right not to be raped. I cannot fathom it, and I've explained it in the plainest English I can muster, and it still doesn't go in. It just doesn't go in. There's a massive obsession with race. I think the hard left is obsessed with race anyway, and I think the hard left has hijacked feminism as they have everything else. And they're obsessed with race, and because these people are brown-skinned, we cannot criticize them. It's a marker, you know, they see it as colonialism, like white people lording it over non-white people. How dare they? This is how they see it. They're obsessed with this. So even if it means repeated and widespread rape, and these are not, these are particularly violent rapes that are happening across Germany and Sweden, they are able to look away from that because the men doing it are brown, and they still see non-white people as victims, all of them. All are victims of white colonialism, which is, of course, a manifestation of white supremacy. I've taken to calling them white supremacists because that's what it is. If you think you are so powerful that everyone is your victim, then you are a white supremacist.
Yes, I'll bet they love that. It's certainly true that I just a brief sort of sidetrack thought here. I have sons and daughters, and I look at generally at Western culture, and I think I envy my daughter rather than my son, in that if you're a girl, basically everything's handed you on a plate now culturally. You're definitely at an advantage over men, except in one respect, and that is that you are also entering a world where you are you can be walking past Marseille train station and you could get stabbed by a man who hates you because you are a woman and you are not, you are improperly dressed. And that's the thing where I don't envy girls today. I'm frightened for our girls. I really
Me
am.
Too. Me too. And it's not just, you know, it's not just about being raped. It's about the culture of fear for women, that when rape is widespread, women are afraid. And they will rein themselves in. They'll restrict themselves. They restrict their own freedom.
Have you seen this new, the new fashion? This so-called modesty dress?
You see, this is it, that's it. It's already happening. We're already...
It is, isn't it?
After years of blaming, you know, of getting to the point where we blame the rapist for rape, we're now turning it into reverse and starting to put the onus on women again because we're becoming Islamic. This is an Islamic... You know, this is what happens in Islamic societies, that women are blamed for rape, and we're effectively doing it here now as well to appease Islam. And, you know, after Cologne, I'm stunned at the response of the mayor of Cologne when she came up with this guide of, code of conduct
for women.
For women. Women had been assaulted in the streets, and she comes up with a code of conduct for women. What does that tell you? We all immediately, when we saw the taharush, the ugly, ugly culture of misogyny, immediately, the first response was to blame it on the women.
Yep.
That's the future.
Yep. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special and very brave guest, I think, Anne-Marie Waters, leader of the For Britain Party. Thank you and goodbye.